Ian Pryor is a film journalist and author of Peter Jackson's From Princess Splatter to Lord of the Rings and joins us on the program. Hello, Ian.
Hi.
Ian, one of the things I've got here, I've got a text here that says, "Hi, Trevor, the most successful Kiwi who didn't want to adopt an Aussie heritage." That's one of the things that you notice about Peter Jackson is that he's really proudly a Kiwi.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that stands out about him is that he's managed to make a whole bunch of movies, you know, really big, expensive films on his own turf, and it just hasn't happened that often in terms of film history. I mean, like Baz Luhrmann over there would be one of the few examples I can think of where you've got a guy who's making really big, expensive films funded by Hollywood, but he's getting to do them at home.
When you take a look at also the charities that he's involved with, he's made sure that a church in Wellington has survived. He's made sure that there's a theatre company in New Zealand, in Wellington as well, that stays there. He's very centred around New Zealand.
Totally, totally. And you know, he had opportunities early on in his career when he was doing some of the early splatter and horror films to make movies in America. But, I mean, part of the reason that he didn't want to do that was that he wanted control. You know, he wanted to be able to make things his own way. So, yeah, definitely the Kiwi thing is a really strong one for him.
What were the opportunities that he had early in his career to move to the States and why?
Some of the early horror films won attention from fans of the genre, and so he was offered horror projects, and at one point he was in the running to work on one of the Nightmare on Elm Street films, and he wrote a script for that actually, but they didn't use it. So there was at least four or five projects in the sort of first 5 or 6 years of his career where he could have gone over there, but I mean a lot of them just were projects that just didn't excite him.
That early, we'll talk a little bit about that and then we'll take a look at his childhood, that early splatter phase, if we can call it that, in his career. How did that start?
How did the splatter period start or yeah. How did the first films?
No, the splatter period start.
Sure thing. I mean, the first feature he made was called Bad Taste, and essentially it was just going to be a short film. So the bizarre thing is that he came out of the gate with this film that did really well and turned a profit pretty quickly, but originally it was just going to be a little movie, and it stretched over 4 years. Every weekend he'd make it in between his full-time job, which was as a photolithographer at a newspaper, which is a job that doesn't exist anymore. But anyway, it just sort of stretched on, and it was this crazy story that just changed as it went along. He had a bunch of mates that he worked with on it, and eventually some of his friends just got sick of working on it because, you know, there wasn't any money involved. So one of them moved to Australia in the end. One of them found God. So they'd leave the project and he'd have to change the plot to sort of write characters out. So he'd kill them off. And then one of the friends that left the project eventually came back. So then he changed the plot again. So, you know, the amazing thing is that the film's actually any good because it's a sort of so many films that people start their careers with are just sort of, you know, they're embarrassing and they never really come to light. But this film eventually went to the Cannes Film Festival and with a bunch of other New Zealand films that year. And it did really well. So that sort of kicked him off.
Does it say something about the New Zealand Film Commission as well? Because they supported that film early in their ability to recognise talent, but not only just... Because if you take a look at the Australian Film Commission, I don't know whether or not they would support a splatter film early. Does it show a bit of forethought from the New Zealand Film Commission?
There have been a few horror films that the Film Commission here has funded over the years. Yeah, I mean, there was a guy who's key in... Peter
not a first Stewart. Director.
Say that again?
Not necessarily a first director.
No, that's true. And you know, to make sure we're truthful about it, I mean, it didn't happen straight away. So he was writing these epic letters to the commission here saying, you know, give me money to make this film. And they basically didn't really go there for a number of years. But it was a guy called Jim Booth who eventually sort of siphoned some small amounts of cash off, who was in charge of the commission at the time. And Booth was actually a key part of the story because he ended up leaving the commission and producing Peter's first couple of films. So yeah, the commission is definitely a really big part of the story. The first three or four films probably wouldn't have got made if it wasn't for the commission.
Let's take a so after that initial film, which was Bad Taste, what did we see after that?
After that, it was a sort of weird thing. He had two movies that were kind of jumping to see which one was going to be first, and he was going to make a zombie film called Brain Dead, which is probably the best of those Slatter movies in my opinion. But what ended up happening was it didn't quite happen. It was about to film, and then one of the investors withdrew their funding. So it was just absolute lunacy what happened next. He had this crazy puppet movie that he'd already done as a short film, and that's the cult movie Meet the Feebles. So because suddenly Brain Dead wasn't going, he wanted to do something quick. He had all this crew ready to go. So I suppose you could argue this is an example of Peter pulling stuff out of the hat, you know, just being positive despite what was going on. And he basically managed to persuade, you could say, the film commission to lend him some money to make this movie, which they didn't even have a script for. And he had some interest from a company in Japan, and they had to write the script in 3 weeks. So they rushed the script through, made this loony script all about a bunch of strange characters, all of them puppets or people in costumes, and they're all rushing to put on a musical show for television. And he managed to get it shot. But it was a disaster, really, because the film went massively over schedule. It was a trial by fire situation, and that film is probably the only really serious bomb of his career. Although, you know, some people think I understand it's got a few fans in Australia, actually.
Okay. Yeah, I got a text here that says, how close was Peter Jackson's Meet the Feebles to the real Muppets? Did he actually take a look at the Muppets and do any parodies from there?
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious from watching the Feebles that the Muppets are part of what's being parodied. I mean, he officially didn't say that, of course, because he doesn't want to get sued by the Muppet Empire or anything.
But no, you don't need that.
No, definitely not, especially not early in your career.
Hello, Charles.
Hello, Trevor. Trevor, Peter Jackson and his philanthropy, he's been involved with the collection of First World War aircraft. Just north of Blenheim in the South Island, you know, in that Marlborough country. I think it's Omaha, a little, sounds like that. There's a little airfield there. And they built a hangar and put this lovely collection of First World War aircraft together. But the feature, I think, that puts Peter's stamp on the collection is some of the dioramas. And they have an aircraft there, the Red Baron, they call it, and it's a take on the capture of the aircraft and the salvaging and the pilfering by the soldiers of the Red Baron's aircraft. And the other thing that's quite predominant in this hangar is a wonderful collection of army uniforms, and it's interesting to see the German uniforms that are collected there as well.
He's got an incredible number of interests, Ian.
Yeah. He's had a really strong interest in war since childhood. I mean, his father came from England, and his father was stationed in Malta during World War II, which, you know, got bombed to smithereens, and his father's father was also a soldier. So yeah, that's long been an interest for him. And as I think it was Charles, wasn't it, was saying, yeah, he's got an incredible collection of aircraft and stuff. He's a bit of a collector, I think we could say.
Yeah. Has he ever had an interest in making war films?
I think it's bound to happen. I mean, you could argue that it's sort of happened already in terms of some of the, you know, the massive war scenes in Lord of the Rings, but he hasn't done it yet. He's talked about it, but there hasn't been one to date. You know, in a historical sense, anyway.
You just touched a little bit about his childhood. Was he from, what sort of a family was he from?
Sure. Both his parents immigrated to New Zealand from England, and they met once they got here. He was an only child. He grew up in a town called Pukerua Bay. His parents were just good people, basically, I suppose you could say. Neither of them was particularly rich, and his father worked as a pay clerk in the local council in Wellington for most of his life. And his mother did this thing called invisible mending, which is actually fixing up women's clothing, like stockings and stuff, which is a job that I guess isn't around anymore, long gone. Yeah, and they basically just really encouraged him, and he got into movies and was watching them on TV as a youngster. And I think there were points where they were a little bit worried about his interest in war and blood and guts and horror films, but they were essentially really encouraging. So it got to the point with some of his early films where he was creating some quite elaborate special effects and makeup and alien masks, for example, for Bad Taste, and they even let him use their oven to create some of the alien masks.
Have you seen the film Super 8?
Yeah, great movie. Really like that film.
Now, is there a, for people who haven't seen Super 8, part of the story is a group of kids who are making a splatter film. Their own miniature version of a zombie film.
Yeah.
And in the 70s, is there a little bit of Peter Jackson in that film?
There could be. I mean, I think once you, if you look at the sort of early lives of a lot of the filmmakers that went on to be big in fantasy and science fiction, there's a, you know, there's a lot of similarities. There's certain magazines and certain films that pop up, and I think that film's as much about Steven Spielberg as it is Peter Jackson probably. But yeah, it's a beautiful movie, yeah, and just these sort of young children that kind of. They're just mad on movies, and mad on fantasy movies. And Ray Harryhausen is another sort of touchstone for a lot of these directors. Ray Harryhausen was a guy, sort of his glory period was in the 50s, and he did this thing called stop motion animation, which is where you know you use these little plasticine figures and move them frame by frame, create the illusion that they're real. And that was another person that Peter was just mad on, and people like Ray Harryhausen helped Peter became a big fan of special effects because it was special effects that kind of pulled him into filmmaking, really.
As in the film Super 8, there's a kid who makes his own films with the Super 8 camera with his friends. And that's where Peter Jackson started. He was given a Super 8 and he began making films then himself.
Exactly. That's totally what happened, yeah. And, using the backyard for creating war scenes in the backyard, even graveyard scenes in the backyard, creating big holes to put coffins in and stuff. So, you know, his parents were pretty understanding.
They were very understanding. One of the films that had a very early influence in his life was, of course, King Kong. Can you tell us how that was influential? And I guess it was important for him to then do a remake of it later in his career.
Yeah, and amazing that came to pass, eh? Yeah, he saw that on television when he was about 8 or 9, and it was just, it sort of blew his mind from what we can tell. I think it was partly this kind of idea of taking you to another place, the way when you watch a movie, it can create another world, and even though it's, even when he saw it, it was a really old film, so I think it's about 1930, the special effects were extremely cutting edge at the time, and it still had a lot of power. So that was a really big film in terms of him influencing him to start trying to create his own effects. As you were saying, he had an 8mm camera to play around with, and he started creating models and little dinosaurs and essentially recreating some of the stuff he'd seen on screen.
Was he influenced by directors, though? I mean, what you're talking about there, because he loved things like Monty Python and that sort of stuff. So he had, and Thunderbirds. So there was an influence of that sort of thing. But were there directors that were influencing him, or was it more a style?
I think it was more. I mean, he basically by the time he was a teenager, he was the sort of guy that was reading everything he could about film. So you know, he certainly had directors that he liked, and horror directors started to come into play. But his tastes in films were pretty wide. But I think the key thing is the special effects, really. It's Thunderbirds and King Kong and Ray Harryhausen and all these influences. They're all about amazing images. You know, they're about spectacular explosions and strange creatures and stuff. Now, you mentioned Monty Python, and that's a really interesting one because it sort of hangs off to the left of all the other films we're talking about, all the other titles. Mm. And he saw there was one particular sketch from Monty Python which he's talked about being kind of a hugely influential, which was a sketch called Salad Days, and it was essentially a bunch of sort of toffee-nosed Brits who were sitting around, and then it turned into a Sam Peckinpah splatter movie, and suddenly there's hands getting lopped off and it all goes totally crazy. So he just kind of loved the ludicrousness of it, and that became something that came through when he started making his own movies. So even though these movies like Brain Dead and Meet the Feebles, they're they've got some incredibly violent material in them, there's a sort of spirit of silliness or a childishness to them that actually makes them a lot more fun than you might expect.
I thought you were going to say the Monty Python thing where there were the two knights that were cutting off each other's limbs saying it's just a flesh wound.
Yeah, that's another great example of the sort of thing. Totally, yeah. You know, it's loaded with blood, and yet it's, you know, you've got to laugh.
Mitch joins us. Hello, Mitch.
G'day, guys. How are you doing?
Good.
Good.
I was just ringing up. Forgive me if I'm bringing up something you've already done. I only just tuned in.
No, you're right.
A little while ago, but as far as Peter Jackson goes, I was a massive Lord of the Rings fan. You know, I loved I love the books, and I really, really enjoyed Peter Jackson's adaptions of it. And I just wanted to know what you guys thought, whether Peter Jackson was influenced by a man by the name of Colin McKenzie.
Oh, now, I want to hear more from you on that. How do you mean influenced by Colin McKenzie?
Oh, well, hang on, I want to know who Colin McKenzie is.
Oh, I think Mitch should be telling us. You tell us, Mitch, and then I'll follow through.
Colin McKenzie is a revolutionary filmmaker from New Zealand. I think he was one of the pioneers of the film industry.
Are you being sarcastic, Mitch, or are you being serious?
No. He's one of the forgotten pioneers of the film industry. It started off just as a humble filmmaker in New Zealand, and I believe he invented a lot of the techniques used in modern day filmmaking.
Totally. Mitch is totally on the button. It's really hard for me to know how to talk about this. There's a movie that Peter and a director called Costa Botes worked on, which was called Forgotten Silver, which tells the story of Colin McKenzie, and it's an extraordinary story, so extraordinary that it's hard to know whether to believe it or not. And I totally recommend you see it. I think it's one of the best films Peter's ever made. And it actually played on television here in New Zealand originally, but it went around the world and went to various festivals. And yeah, this Colin McKenzie guy invented colour film, among other things, and recorded footage of someone, one of the first people to fly before the Wright brothers. So it's a pretty extraordinary story. And there are similarities to Lord of the Rings in terms of, in one part of the movie, Colin goes down south and makes this massive biblical epic, goes on location. But I don't know what else we want to say about that one, Mitch. What do you reckon?
Well, I just think Peter Jackson, the revolutionary filmmaker that he is, owes a bit of a throwback to Colin McKenzie.
Mitch, how come you know so much about Colin McKenzie?
Well, I think he's a pioneer that should be recognised a little bit more.
Okay.
I think we've got a special call here. I can't argue with any of that, Mitch. So, I think we'd both recommend that everyone rush out and get a copy of that film.
Why are you laughing there,
Ian? Know what we're talking about, eh?
Is it amongst filmmakers? Is this guy an in joke? Well, not an in joke, but just recognised in some ways.
Yeah, I think that'd be one way to describe it. Yep.
After the splatter films that Jackson made, did that give him any sort of kudos in the film industry itself, or was he sort of looked upon as, oh, well, he just makes splatter movies?
Yeah, I think you've nailed it pretty well, actually. I mean, certainly the films sold really well internationally. He won major respect in terms of those movies, you know. So Braindead is pretty much seen to be one of the best splatter films ever made. But, yeah, at the same time, he hadn't made a film that was the sort of film that would be raved. No, I mean, I was about to say that he hadn't made a film that had been raved about by mainstream critics, but that's actually wrong, because some of them did rave about the splatter films. But it was basically Heavenly Creatures that kind of was the transition movie, where he was making another film that involved murder, but it was a very different one. It was based on an infamous murder that happened in New Zealand in Christchurch in the 50s, where two teenage girls murdered one of their mothers. So it was a really strange and unusual case. And the film that came out is actually completely different from anything he'd made, or anything he's ever made, actually. And, you know, suddenly he was at major film festivals winning big awards. Mm. He was getting rave reviews from Time magazine, and he was getting nominated for Oscars, him and his partner Fran Walsh, for their script. So that was a really big part of the story.
But now, can I just, because I've got a text here that says the Colin McKenzie movie was a hoax. Can't believe that you didn't know that.
I didn't know that. That's funny.
Is Colin McKenzie to film directing the same as those? I'm just trying to think of the band. Was it a send up film of a director?
Well, part of what makes Forgotten Silver really interesting is that the way it's played, it's many viewers find it pretty persuasive, so it's not like Spinal Tap.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it just for the equivalent of Spinal Tap in film?
Yeah, I mean, it's you could argue that, yeah. I think Mitch and I just both enjoyed it a lot. We don't want to totally ruin it.
For other people, fair enough.
Yeah.
Stuart joined us. Hello, Stuart.
Stuart, yes, that's me.
Yes,
how you doing, Trevor?
Good.
there's a certain irony about all this. You having the name Trevor Chappell and speaking about people from across the Dutch.
Yeah, no, we're keeping that one on a low profile.
I won't go there.
Right, let's not mention underarm. Okay, that's fine. Although it was well within the rules at the time.
Indeed.
Yeah, right. Let's not just keep that little bit of war going. What else do you want to talk about?
No, just I heard earlier that you wanted to... you were talking about Peter Jackson, and having been an advocate for the wrongly imprisoned and whatnot, being an Australian and advocating for a lot of people in the USA who have been imprisoned for various things, and Brad, your, I think, producer or phone guy, said I can't really get too deep into
this. No, you can talk about the West Memphis 3.
Oh, I can?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay, well, I was very, very attached to that case until they were released. I think you might know that Peter and his wife, Fran, financed the attorneys who sought their release and whatnot. I made several trips to the USA and I spent time with Damien's mother, the father of one of the kids who was murdered, Christopher Byers, John Mark Byers. Was the father, and I just don't believe that the court got it right.
Yeah, look, what we need to do is go back. And thank you for bringing it up, because I was going to mention this, but we can't go into the full story of the West Memphis 3 because it's far, far too long. But for listeners who aren't aware, it was a case in the States where people were imprisoned and found guilty for the murder of some children. And it was a nasty case. And one of the things that Peter Jackson was involved in was the defence for these three who were then later... were later released, but they weren't acquitted for the crimes.
Right.
But it's an incredible story where you take a look at his passion to be involved in such a thing. And I think, and there was a film made, and if people want to see the film, it's not a bad film, called The West Memphis 3, which is a documentary. And I think he was involved in the making of that film as well, Ian?
Yeah, he produced West of Memphis, yes, indeed. And as is being said, put a lot of money into it, yeah. We should mention a couple of other films as well, because there's a series of three movies on the case called Paradise Lost, which, the first one was made a number of years ago. Yeah, it's a horrifying case, eh? It just seems so transparently for there to have been an injustice that occurred. So it's, he hasn't produced many films either, so obviously he had a really strong interest in this case to have even got involved.
But it's interesting in his interest in that way, because we heard about the Air Museum. He's been involved in that case with the West Memphis 3,
yep.
The saving of a church and a theatre company. It seems that he's also well-read and interested in, for want of a better term, current affairs or what's happening in the world.
Yeah, how do I answer that one? I guess that could be argued. I mean, he's an incredibly busy guy. I mean, he's got a lot of stuff on his plate. And when he's making a movie like The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, the fact he's even got time to be involved in some of this other stuff is pretty amazing. So, yeah, I don't know if I'd say he's a major current affairs type of guy, but clearly something in this case really pricked at him and with Fran too, I would imagine.
But if he gets an interest, then he's not going to go, oh, that's interesting, and then walk away from it. If he's really interested in it, then he's going to be involved.
Yeah, certainly that's obviously occurred on some of these occasions, yep.
Let's then go back into the movies that he's made. We've covered that Heavenly Creatures sort of, I guess, paved his way into making films that are a little bit more accessible to more people. How did his career then move on?
Interesting period just after that. He sort of had all this stuff happen at once. But basically, Heavenly Creatures, you know, won him a lot of attention. And it won him a deal with an American company called Miramax, who had made their name dealing with a lot of sort of indie-type films and breaking them open in America. So suddenly he had interest for Miramax, and he was also making his first big film for Hollywood, which was The Frighteners with Michael J. Fox, which... didn't do awesomely well, but it's still an important film. It's the first time that Peter really got serious with digital effects. There'd been a little bit of digital effects going on in Heavenly Creatures, but The Frighteners has got a lot more of them. And so that's kind of, I don't know, if should we lead into Lord of the Rings here? Because that sort of starts to come into the picture.
But just, can I just say with that, he still managed to get these films made in New Zealand, didn't he? Which was pretty amazing.
Definitely, definitely. So as we were saying at the opening, and, you know, again like Baz Luhrmann, you've got a situation where he's making a... It wasn't a mega film by American standards, but, you know, it was some serious cash, a really long shooting schedule, and he's managed to sort out a way to actually shoot the entire thing here and do the effects here as well. And that's at a point where, you know, Weta Digital is not the monster it is today. It's an unknown force. You've got these Hollywood executives thinking, you know, this is a little bit risky. They might not even pull this off. But essentially what happened was the effects were really good, and the studio had another movie that wasn't on schedule. So suddenly they put some more money into The Frighteners and rushed it forward for release, but unfortunately it didn't do very well.
Was it important that they were able to do good special effects? Because this is like fairly early in what we see as as commonplace in digital technology, I suppose. So was it important for the future of his filmmaking that was successful?
Well, I guess we could argue that no, in the sense that it was going to carry through. But no, you're right. In terms of the effects, that is true, because obviously, you know, special effects and imagery and monsters, etc., are kind of key to some of the films that followed. So, yeah, I mean, there was a Grim Reaper type creation who was created for The Frighteners, and he was pretty much all digital effects, and, you know, he was an amazing thing, this kind of flying shadowy creature with a big cape. So even though it's kind of a mixed bag, my understanding is The Frighteners is a film that you're not really meant to mention out in Peter Jackson land here in Wellington, but it's still a key film, and it's a really interesting period where Weta is expanding at incredible speed. You know, you're started off with one guy in a room desperately working his butt off on Heavenly Creatures, but it's ramping up during that period, and there's a few other films that were coming through there. Forgotten Silver, which we mentioned, has got some effects in it too. But essentially what happens at the end of it is that Peter's thinking, I've got all this computer equipment and crew, but what am I going to do with it all when The Frighteners comes to an end? If he doesn't have another big project ready to go, he was in danger of losing this team that he'd created. So what he did is he decided that a big fantasy movie was the obvious answer. And so, you know, if you're thinking fantasy, Tolkien is the king of fantasy. Mm. So that's where he got the idea of doing something like The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings.
Ian, for years people have been talking about the making of The Lord of the Rings and when somebody was going to do it. Firstly, we know that he'd been interested in that book for a long time. How did he get the rights?
Yeah, wish you hadn't asked me that question. The rights were a really big nightmare. Essentially, a guy called Sol Zaintz, who's a producer, he had the rights because he'd done an animated version of part of Lord of the Rings in the late 70s. So basically, Peter rang up his representatives in America, and they checked with Sol Zaintz. But essentially, the reason why it all started to happen, this loony idea of this guy from New Zealand getting a chance to make it, was that luck came into play, and that was Miramax, the company that were already really keen on Peter. They were owed a favour by Sol Zaintz because he had had a film called The English Patient, which they rescued The English Patient and came in and got it going when another studio dropped it. So basically it all kind of was this amazing thing where the company that wanted to work with Peter were owed a favour by the guy that had the rights. So that makes it sound simple, but basically after that there was a whole lot of extended negotiations and wrangling, and the rights to The Hobbit were really complicated, remained so for many years, split between a few different organisations. So it became clear that Lord of the Rings was a slightly easier proposition in terms of actually getting a chance to make it.
So is that why The Lord of the Rings was made after The Hobbit? Before
The Hobbit. Exactly.
Yeah, because everyone said that. Why on earth would you make The Lord of the Rings first?
Totally. I mean, when you look at them, I mean, obviously we kind of know the way it turned out, but when you look at them, especially in terms of the films that Peter had made and his interests, The Hobbit's kind of the more obvious one to start with. It's less serious, it's more comical, it's it just sort of suits Peter's what he'd done up till then better than Lord of the Rings. But you know, the whole epic story carried on a lot longer, because even though Miramax was the key to opening the door, they weren't ultimately the company that made it. And that was partly because Miramax could only access so much cash. They were owned by Disney at the time, and they didn't have enough money to do it as two movies. So ultimately, they gave them a pretty short period to find someone else to fund it, to make it as a two-part movie, because they were essentially threatening that the only way it would happen would be if it was done as one film.
There you go. So all of you out there that wanted to know why on earth he didn't make The Hobbit first, it was because he didn't have the rights to The Hobbit first. Now, if you're going to take on something like The Lord of the Rings, it's a huge project, and you've got to have a lot of money behind you to do it. Where did he get the money, and who produced it?
So in that earlier period, when it was originally with Miramax, they put in at least $12 million American dollars. So, you know, there was a whole extended research and development period and helping design it and working on the digital effects. So Miramax put in a lot of money. Ultimately, the film was made by another company called New Line, and New Line, you know, footed the bill, basically. There was also some distribution deals going on with various companies around the world had a hand in the film. So, yeah, as you say, it was this massive project and cost a lot of money, but the idea was that making three movies in one go would save money. And it was a fairly, you know, fairly rare event in film history to make three movies at once, because usually the thing is, there's been a number of times that the two movies have been made at once, but the risk obviously is that if you start making the first one and then no one goes to see it, you've already wasted all that cash on filming the second one, you know, so you could argue that it's financially insane to do it. So it was a massive risk by New Line to go there in the first place.
I guess within that, though, it has been such a popular book and read by so many people, and there have been so many people wanting to see the film, that there's a relative, it's a sort of a sure bet, because there are enough Lord of the Ring freaks out there to go and see it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you could argue there's no such thing as a sure bet in the movie business, but yeah, you're right. It sounds like, you know, it would be a pretty intelligent one to go with. But you know, by the same token, there was I'm not saying it was quite as famous as Lord of the Rings, but, you know, there was The Golden Compass, which is a pretty well-regarded fantasy book. New Line put, I think, about $180 million into that, having the same kind of thinking later on, and that film did not do very well at all.
True. When you take a look at that then, was there much support given from the New Zealand Film Commission and also from the New Zealand government to support the project?
There was definitely major support from the New Zealand government, so they definitely were keen and put money in. The Film Commission's a whole other story, which I don't know if we'll have time for today, actually. But, yeah, essentially Peter's got a sort of complicated relationship with the commission, and by this stage, you know, it was kind of, we're talking about a big international film, so the commission would never have had the resources to really have done much there anyway.
What was the project like for him? Because it would be a lot from the heart. Did he enjoy the process of making that film or the series?
I think it's kind of, you could probably be fair enough to describe it as sort of heaven and hell at the same time. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, he loves making films, he loves being on a set, but just the sheer scale of it, I mean, the main shoot for the three movies went on for like over a year, starting in late 1999. You're talking an immensely complicated project, you know, just basic things like the fact that the characters are different sizes, so lots of scenes, just setting up a scene where you've got short hobbits and tall wizards in the same shot means that everything's slowed down, so he's got all these shorter actors involved, so he's shooting scenes twice, he's shooting scenes on sets that are two different sizes, he's got all the digital effects, so yeah, I mean...
It's a lot of direction.
Say that again?
It's a lot of direction.
Yeah, and you know, it was a rare time. Up till then, he'd very rarely used second unit directors, which are, you know, essentially another crew that are helping a film get made. But the scale of this one was that he had to give over scenes to other people.
How did he feel about the success and awards that he was starting to win? Was he comfortable with that?
Oh, I think that, I mean, I think he's a complicated guy. I mean, he's a pretty private guy in some ways. He's, you know, he's very good with the media. He's done lots of interviews, but he's not the sort of guy that's out and about all the time and everything. So I'm sure there was some adjustment going on, but you know, it was at the same time, this movie had done incredibly well, and it was really important to his career that the first film especially did really well, because obviously, you know, if the first film had bombed or even only done mediumly, then it would have put the other two into jeopardy. So yeah.
Ian, has he ever said why he decided, out of the smallest of all the books, he decided to split that up into a couple of films when it could have been done in one with The Hobbit?
I don't know if he has or not, actually. I mean, The Hobbit's history is complicated too, because originally he wasn't going to make that. I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, but there's a really talented director called Guillermo del Toro who was originally going to do it. But in the end, the rights again rose up. I mean, the rights to The Hobbit were still complicated, and they were caught up in a company that essentially was bankrupt. So in the end, I suspect that Peter stepped in to take over The Hobbit partly because, you know, the project was in danger of falling over without him. Guillermo departed and said, you know, I can't wait any longer. I've got to go off and make another movie. And so, yeah, so Peter stepped in. And originally it was going to be two movies, but basically the argument was that there was so much good material as they filmed them that they came up with the idea of extending it to three.
We're only about a minute away from the news. In between, we haven't spoken about The Lovely Bones, which was a lovely film, which was a much smaller production film to be made in the middle of that, which is a terrific movie. What's his future? Do you know what he's looking at doing next, Ian?
He's always got a lot of projects on the go. I think it's a really key time for his career because yeah, another smaller film, something a little bit more offbeat, would probably be, I don't know if I should say a good idea, but you know, he's done these mega films and he spent so long in Middle Earth making these massive, spectacular films that it'll be interesting to see if he picks something smaller to follow up on. And he's also supposed to be doing another Tintin film, so we'll just have to wait and see.
Ian, it's been a pleasure talking to you this morning. Thank you for giving us some insight into Peter Jackson's life.
Cheers.
Ian Pryor, who's a film journalist and the author of Peter Jackson, from Prince of Splatter to The Lord of the Rings, and so many different things in between, like King Kong and The Lovely Bones, which is a great film if you haven't seen it. You're listening to Overnights with Trevor Chappell on ABC Radio, and it's time for us to head off to the next ABC News.